History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some powerful stories right around you just waiting to be told. The idea, first and foremost, is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we just take a little time to do that, we all benefit. We're educated, we're entertained, and maybe most importantly, we end up inspired by these memories from what's been called our greatest generation. As we get closer and closer to the 75th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy, we are showcasing the stories of Americans who were there on June 6, 1944. Today, you'll hear the voices of three different D-Day veterans, one who is still very much alive and will have a very special role in France on the 75th anniversary, and also two men who are no longer with us, but whose recollections will add to our perspective of D-Day and the bigger picture. On June 6, 2019, President Donald Trump will be in Normandy, just as President Barack Obama was for the 70th anniversary in 2014. But aside from President Franklin D. Roosevelt's original radio broadcast on June 6, 1944, when he led the nation in prayer, the most well-known presidential speech with regard to D-Day came on the 40th anniversary, when President Ronald Reagan, who had served in the Army Air Corps himself during World War II, stood on Normandy's cliffs with some of the invasion's most courageous heroes.
We're here to mark that day in history when the Allied armies joined in battle to reclaim this continent to liberty. For four long years, much of Europe had been under a terrible shadow. Free nations had fallen. Jews cried out in the camps. Millions cried out for liberation. Europe was enslaved and the world prayed for its rescue. Here in Normandy, the rescue began. Here the Allies stood and fought against tyranny in a giant undertaking unparalleled in human history. We stand on a lonely, windswept point on the northern shore of France. The air is soft, but 40 years ago at this moment, the air was dense with smoke and the cries of men, and the air was filled with the crack of rifle fire and the roar of cannon. At dawn on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion, to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns. The Allies had been told that some of the mightiest of these guns were here, and they would be trained on the beaches to stop the Allied advance. The Rangers looked up and saw the enemy soldiers at the edge of the cliffs shooting down at them with machine guns and throwing grenades, and the American Rangers began to climb. They shot rope ladders over the face of these cliffs and began to pull themselves up. When one Ranger fell, another would take his place. When one rope was cut, a Ranger would grab another and begin his climb again. They climbed, shot back, and held their footing. Soon, one by one, the Rangers pulled themselves over the top, and in seizing the firm land at the top of these cliffs, they began to seize back the continent of Europe. 225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. And behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Puente Hope. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war. Gentlemen, I look at you and I think of the words of Stephen Spender's poem. You are men who in your, quote, lives fought for life and left the vivid air signed with your honor. I think I know what you may be thinking right now. Thinking we were just part of a bigger effort. Everyone was brave that day. Well, everyone was. Do you remember the story of Bill Millen of the 51st Highlanders? 40 years ago today, British troops were pinned down near a bridge, waiting desperately for help. Suddenly they heard the sound of bagpipes, and some thought they were dreaming. Well, they weren't. They looked up and saw Bill Millen with his bagpipes leading the reinforcements and ignoring the smack of the bullets into the ground around him. Lord Lovett was with him, Lord Lovett of Scotland, who calmly announced when he got to the bridge, "Sorry, I'm a few minutes late," as if he'd been delayed by a traffic jam, when in truth he'd just come from the bloody fighting on Sword Beach, which he and his men had just taken. There was the impossible valor of the Poles, who threw themselves between the enemy and the rest of Europe as the invasion took hold, and the unsurpassed courage of the Canadians, who had already seen the horrors of war on this coast. They knew what awaited them there, but they would not be deterred. And once they hit Juneau Beach, they never looked back. All of these men were part of a roll call of honor, with names that spoke of a pride as bright as the colors they bore. The Royal Winnipeg Rifles, Poland's 24th Lancers, the Royal Scots Fusiliers, the Screaming Eagles, the Yeomen of England's Armored Divisions, the Forces of Free France, the Coast Guard's Matchbox Fleet, the American Rangers. 40 summers have passed since the battle that you fought here. You were young the day you took these cliffs. Some of you were hardly more than boys with the deepest joys of life before you. Yet you risked everything here. Why? Why did you do it? What impelled you to put aside the instinct for self-preservation and risk your lives to take these cliffs? What inspired all the men of the armies that met here? We look at you and somehow we know the answer. It was faith and belief. It was loyalty and love. The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest. You were here to liberate, not to conquer, and so you and those others did not doubt your cause, and you were right not to doubt. You all knew that some things are worth dying for. One's country is worth dying for, and democracy is worth dying for, because it's the most deeply honorable form of government ever devised by man. All of you loved liberty. All of you were willing to fight tyranny, and you knew the people of your countries were behind you. The Americans who fought here that morning knew word of the invasion was spreading through the dark home. They fought, or felt in their hearts, though they couldn't know in fact, that in Georgia they were filling the churches at 4 a.m. In Kansas they were kneeling on their porches and praying. And in Philadelphia they were ringing the Liberty Bell. Something else helped the men of D-Day: their rock-hard belief that Providence would have a great hand in the events that would unfold here, that God was an ally in this great cause. And so the night before the invasion, when Colonel Wolverton asked his parachute troops to kneel with him in prayer, he told them, "Do not bow your heads, but look up so you can see God and ask his blessing in what we are about to do." Also that night, General Matthew Ridgway on his cot, listening in the darkness for the promise God made to Joshua, "I will not fail thee nor forsake thee." These are the things that impelled them. These are the things that shaped the unity of the Allies.
That was President Ronald Reagan on June 6, 1984. You can access that entire speech at hometownheroesradio.com. But as we zero in on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, we hear the memories of men who were there. Varm Kiramijian was part of a 5-inch gun crew. He was the trainer on the number 2 turret aboard the USS Satterlee, a destroyer assigned specifically to support and protect that 2nd Ranger Battalion that President Reagan praised.
We were the first ship into the range of Normandy there. The Germans had 5 88-millimeter guns on this point that protruded clear out, the furthest protrusion out to the ocean. And those 5 88s had to be taken out before the invasion force came. And this was their job and our job to try to protect all we could to get them landed. And the barge would be at 50 Rangers on it. It was 50 in each landing barge. And that barge would take off and it'd start circling in a big circle out in the ocean. And then they'd load another one off of the troop ship that was back there. And the other barge, they loaded, as soon as they loaded 5 barges up with the Rangers, Colonel Rudder was ahead of that Ranger Battalion, the Army 2nd Ranger Battalion. We call them Suicide Bunch. They circled, and then all of a sudden they said, okay, we're going in. And as soon as they said we're going in, we were already in underneath that 100-foot cliffs setting there, waiting for the word. And as soon as the word came out that they're coming in, they're going to go in and land. Well, the land wasn't much of a land because the cliffs were sheer cliffs all the way right down to the waterfront. And we were there trying not to get grounded. The German 88s, they could not train down at us. They can't train down at us because we were right in the bottom of that cliff.
The angle was too steep for them, but you could shoot up at them.
Yeah, we could shoot. Oh, yeah. We could shoot up at them. As the Rangers came in, we started a rapid fire, strafing the top of the cliffs, and the Germans would come out there one at a time, two at a time, and they had these big hand grenades, 18 inches long, where we have those throwing grenades. And they'd rush up to the edge of the cliff there, and they would just literally drop the hand grenades down at the Rangers landing with their barges. A couple of barges were hit before they even got to the landing. But soon as they got on the little stretch of land that was right below, they had these grapnel hooks with these big coils of wire. They'd set these tripod grapnel hooks and they'd shoot them up on the cliff, and then they'd get a hold. Once the grapnel hook would take a hold, the Rangers would, one at a time, they would grab the ropes and start hightailing it up one by one along the cliff there.
And you were watching all this unfold through your long-range sight on the gun?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, could see it all what's going on. These Rangers are loaded with their whole backpacks and guns and ammunition that they carried and grenades they carried, because once they get on top, you know, they have to have all that stuff up there. We rapid fired practically all day long, knocking off any Germans that would come up to the edge of the cliff there. They would never get back because we would get them. Constant rapid fire. They'd come out of those cement trenches that they had between each one of those 88 guns. We'd have to mow them down. Once they got up there, the big surprise was that the Germans had moved, pulled the 88s out of the bunkers, the cement bunkers, and moved them back of an apple orchard was back there, because the Air Force bombed that Point de Hoc, they called it. We called it Point de Ho then. They bombed that with tons and tons of bombs. So when the Rangers got up there, the bunkers were empty. They fought their way to the end of the apple orchard and found, by following the tracks, they found the 588s there. And what they did, the rangers did, they have these here canisters that they light, and they drop them in the breech box of each one of those 88s, and it would melt. That gun is out of order. They no more, they could never use that gun anymore. And out of that 250 rangers that landed on Point de Hoc, we got word that 90 rangers went on to fight the war. The rest of them were all killed or casualties. We expended all of our magazines. We had no more shells left. We went across the channel. We were the first ship to leave the channel, went back to Plymouth, England, and when we got there, the docks were just loaded with pallets of ammunition. Everybody on the ship, we had a work detail. We loaded all of our magazines back up, and we got there a little after 6 o'clock that evening, and that's when we worked the whole way through. And we went back the next morning. We went back to Normandy. And when we got back there, there was a destroyer, USS Meredith. It was a brand spanking new 2250 class destroyer, was sunk right there at the beach. It all was sticking out of the water was its forward top side. It was sunk.
And here you had gone dawn to dusk, nonstop shelling at the very start of the invasion of Europe, and come out of that virtually unscathed. And I guess you probably looked at the Meredith and said, that could have been us.
We never even took small arms fire. We had to get out from underneath the cliff there and turn around and take another position, and that's where we got straddled one time. It had to be mortar shell, and never got hit, never took a small arm fire whatsoever, and the ship never got hit not one time.
Did you ever think, while you were on that number two gun, which is facing forward, looking toward the cliff, that you make a pretty good target if you're on that big 5-inch gun, which is doing a lot of the damage to the Germans, that they would like to take you out?
Oh, yeah. They had a lot of things to take out on us, but not one hit. We never took a hit. How we did that, Lord knows, I don't know. It's been a mystery to me why we were never even hit with small arm fire. Because, see, the Germans had machine gun nests stationed up there on top side, and we had to take those out immediately. And any time there was a Spitfire out on coming from the shore, the R-20s and 40s would be on them right off the bat. Take them out.
I have to imagine that was probably one of the longest days of your life. When I read an article that says the longest break in the shelling was 20 minutes to eat K-rations, and you guys fired every ounce of ammunition you had before heading back to England, what was that like to just have nonstop war, nonstop battle from the start of the day to the end of the day?
We took in a lot of smoke in those 5-inch 38s turrets. Because every time we fire rapid fire, the whole thing would be full of smoke. Of course, everybody's yakking and coughing and everything. We have guys, we call him the hot shell man. He would try to catch every one of those hot shells and throw them down the cubbyhole onto the main deck. Of course, when the end of that day, the whole top of the forecastle decks was just covered with empty shell casings.
Nowhere to walk, huh?
Nowhere to go, yeah. They wore asbestos gloves clear up to their shoulders so they wouldn't get burnt with those shells coming out.
When you were staring through that sight, which gave you a closer view of what was going on than a lot of the guys on the ship with you, you saw those rangers struggling up that sheer cliff face, what you call the suicide mission, and what the numbers show certainly was for a lot of them. Was there one thing that you saw that was really powerful? Something that still maybe has some symbolic value today when you think back on what you witnessed on that day?
Those guys, how many hours of training they had before this here invasion, and you got to take your hat off for them rangers. And you wonder, well, what kind of guys are these guys? They didn't give a darn. Well, practically none of us knew. or cared at those days. We had a purpose. We had a project we had to do, and we did to the best of our knowledge.
Did that inspire you to see what was clearly a very brave action by these men?
Definitely. Definitely. You have to be pretty darn brave to do what those Rangers did. Yeah, you betcha. They're getting fired on. Not only getting fired on, we're firing over their heads. Constant firing over their heads ahead of them, taking care of our business that we had to do.
Well, and clearly that was a pivotal day, if not the pivotal day in the entire war, as the Allied invasion of Europe began that day. That action by the Rangers climbing to the top of that cliff and taking out the German position was crucial to the victory, and I think has symbolic value in the greater fight. Did you have an idea on that day that it would become as big a deal and be such a monumental moment all these years later?
Never crossed our minds. Did not realize what it meant to do this job. We just figured, that's what we're here for. We trained many hours doing what we had to do. I guess that's what paid off.
Did you have any idea how many ships were behind you and how big this force was heading toward Europe?
Well, we had an idea, but it was just whole ocean is just covered with ships. So there'll never be another one like that. Never. That was the biggest armada of ships that was put together for that invasion ever. And there'll never be another one, because now missiles are shot 60 miles away and hits targets. So they won't need any armada like that again. There was a lot of guys gave up their lives for this freedom that we do have. What else can you say? That's what you went there for. And that's what you did, and you're lucky to get back alive, not in a box.
Varm Karamidzian carried that perspective until his passing in 2013. You can pull up his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we have much more to come as we count down to the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our countdown to D-Day's 75th anniversary with the memories of Americans who experienced that longest day firsthand 3/4 of a century ago. One of those thousands of Americans coming ashore at Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944, was Idaho native Philip Houck, known as Pete to friends and his widow Beverly, who still has so many of the letters they exchanged during the war. Pete had a very unique assignment very early on that longest day.
At 3:45 in the morning, my crew went overboard on the ship, climbed down a rope netting into a 22-foot rubber raft. It was powered by a Lee J engine, which was electric, made absolutely no noise. And with an azimuth and a compass in my hand, we headed for the beach. Our job that night was to take out the big tank embutments that are pieces of steel that are crossed with 12-inch steel embedded in 15 feet of concrete, and they're a blockage so that trucks and tanks cannot reach the shore. And they were pretty sure that these would not be knocked out by the naval guns, and they weren't. So we went into the beach, and we put these bandoliers and C2 around the concrete portions, hoping to get it as far down as we could. I remember Earl, he said to me, he had a hold of my belt, and he said, "Bob, what the hell is this?" And of course, he had his hand on a trigger mine, and I said, "Well, if you don't let go of it easily, it could blow you up." I said, "It's a mine," and I won't say what he said.
I can imagine.
But we put our detonators in there and then put a time charge on them so that they would go off. It was scheduled, I think, for, my memory's not so good, I think 5:45 or 6 o'clock was the time that was going to be the big firing. And then we headed back to our ship, and that was another scary time. If you can imagine, you're in a little boat, and these huge ships are covering that sea, and they're about 40 to 60 feet above you, and you're trying to find the ship you're supposed to go back to, and there are literally thousands of them. Well, fortunately, our number was 575. And I spotted that number, and we got there just as they started hitting the beach with the big guns off of the ships, and the noise was unbelievable. You couldn't hear. Actually, you couldn't hear anything. You couldn't, not a thing. And after a few minutes, you couldn't see a thing. And if you could, you couldn't through the tears that were just automatically coming from the sulfur and the smell. You know, bad. But anyway, then I went back in. My first trip on the truck, of course, was at 10 o'clock in the morning. The vehicles that we used in those days were fairly simple, but they had to be waterproofed. It'd be difficult for you folks to understand this, but they had to be waterproofed right up to about your belt line. And I was on my vehicle, that means about 5 foot. But we had to put a tubing over the carburetor, the breather intake. We had to set the gas pedal, the throttle, and everything had to be preset. And when you started your vehicle to go offshore or onshore, everything had to be set. But prior to that, they dug a trench a quarter of a mile long with 5 foot of water in it, and before we loaded our vehicles on the LCTs, they had to pass the test of running through this 5 foot of water without stalling. The first two trucks ahead of me, of course, stalled. So they took them out, and that put me number one in line. So when I was fortunate enough to go through and get right up to the front of the ship, so when they dropped that nose of that LCT, that's where I was, first truck off.
And what, describe for our listeners, if you can, what this truck was like, what the purpose of it was, and why it was so important to be over there on that beach.
Okay, I had what they called a coffin box right behind my seat. It was made out of 3/4-inch steel, and it was full of C2. That's a highly explosive. We had been training with dynamite, but C2 came out and was invented about that time. So we switched over to C2. On my right, standing in the seat, was Lieutenant White, and he was manning a 30-caliber machine gun. So when we came off that ramp onto the into the water, we were the first ones, and I guess maybe by surprise, we dropped into the water, and the water was up around my belly button. It had passed my belt. And the captain said, "For God's sake, are we going to hit the ground?" And about that time, all eight wheels driving, we hit the ground.
Those had to be some nervous moments there. You could be sinking into the drink and holding up everyone else behind you.
That's right. But we made that, and in my shirt pocket and studied for weeks was the direction in which I was supposed to go. And, of course, I had a compass mounted on my rig, and there was a little ravine to my right, which we headed for. And unfortunately, the sea was red with blood. The foam was red. You couldn't hardly breathe. So much sulfur in the air from explosions. The noise was baffling. And I was driving over pieces of human being.
I can see you and hear you. I know our listeners can hear you. They hear the emotion in your voice, and I can almost feel what that does to you, to take yourself back to that moment. And here you are. You're a 23-year-old kid witnessing all this.
It wasn't what I expected. But anyway, we got up into the ravine where they could not fire ammunition our way. And I said, "Well, how far up this ravine you want to go, Lieutenant?" And he said, "Why don't you stop it right here, and we'll wait for the crew to come up." Well, he stepped out of the unit, and I was sitting there shaking. And the warmth that was running down my legs was not from the ocean. I was scared to death.
Who could blame you? And anyone who's seen or read anything about that day and that location knows that there were many men who did not live to talk about it, and you had witnessed so many of them. And it sounds like at that moment you felt like you were probably going to be next.
You really, at that time, didn't know. There were probably several thousand bodies on the beach and many that never made the beach. And when the lieutenant came back, he said, "I would like you to round up your crew." My crew was 14 men, and we were in demolition. And he said, "There are two bunkers that are still alive." That means that they were still firing on the troops down on the beach. And he said, "See what you guys can do about blowing it up." The Germans called them Weiterstandnesters. They're made of 12-foot-thick concrete with 1-inch reinforced rod running through them. They have a small donkey train inside linking them together where they haul their ammunition and stuff. And they only had a slit in the front part of these Weiterstandnesters that was about 6 inches, maybe 8, wide, and ran the full length of a 25-foot bunker. And in that, they would have machine guns on what they call arbitrating fire. It would fire back and forth and interlink and back and forth. There were really no men shooting per se through sights at the men on the beach. But there were so many thousand rounds going down and so many thousand men, the automatic machine guns couldn't miss anybody.
Absolutely. It's just a wall of gunfire, basically.
Yeah, right. That they were up against.
Right.
So pretty soon Earl came up. That's Earl Couch, my best friend. And he said, "What's on the docket, Pop?" And I said, "Well, leave your rifle, your canteens, anything extra you got, and put 25 pounds of explosives on your back, and pots and Meyer." And the 14 of us started crawling to the back I think is bunker number three, or Weiterstand Nestor number three. And he said, Jesus Christ, who's going to be our backup? Meaning, who's going to protect us? Well, the 1340th engineers were primarily our backup, and they came behind us just with their own rifles. And so we worked our way up to the back door of number three, and we put all of this powder or putty, whatever you want to call it. Some comes in brick, and some you can roll up in your hand and put around a tree and cut a tree down. But we blew the back door out, and then the 1340th came up and killed everybody that came out the door. And then we did that to one other one, and I keep forgetting whether it was Weiterstand Nestor 2 or 3. And as soon as we finished that one, we had a little whistle that if an officer needed someone, or if there was a new project or something coming up that we recognized. And I don't know who it was that gave us the high sign, but we then went to where the trucks were trying to come up off of the sand, and they wanted us to build a road and out of steel netting. Then we went into that road, and it was dark when we quit. I can't even remember, like maybe 8 o'clock at night or 7. And, of course, there was no chow that night and nothing to sleep in, so we slept in the sand. And that was the first day.
The first and, as it's been called, the longest. But he had many more. Wounded 6 months later in the Battle of the Bulge, he made it home to marry his sweetheart, Beverly. That was the voice of Pete Houck, who passed away in 2016. You can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a D-Day vet who is not only still with us, he'll be in Normandy for the 75th anniversary, and not just as a spectator or honored guest. He has a very special job to do, one for which he is well equipped. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing you for the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion by listening to firsthand accounts from that fateful moment in world history. The vast majority of the Americans who stormed Fortress Europe on June 6, 1944 are no longer with us. Some of those few who remain will be in France for the 75th anniversary, and one of them will be conducting an orchestra made up of 10 different musical groups from around the U.S. Colonel Arnold Gabriel has done just about everything you can do in the musical world. He was there at Normandy for the 70th anniversary, conducting a similar collection of musicians. But if you can get this almost 94-year-old to slow down enough in his active schedule to talk about it, as he did a few years ago with us in front of a live audience of students at Clovis North High School in California, he'll tell you how he experienced D-Day with the 29th Infantry Division as a 19-year-old.
Well, it was fear, confusion, fright, a little bit of everything. Nobody landed where they were supposed to. Not the 82nd Airborne, who jumped before we hit the beach. We hit the beach way left of where we were supposed to, and I ended up with the 1st Division, which was on our left flank. I was then with the 116th Easy Company, and I said, I've got to get back to the 29th Division. And so, total confusion. I didn't have my machine gun because I left that in the water. The water was up to my waist, and most of us either that deep or some have never made it, drowned before they got to the beach. But anyway, so I made my way back to the 29th and ended up with I Company, the 175th. And they said, we need a machine gunner. You're going to be with us now. I said, well, you better call E Company so they know I'm not dead. So that's what they did. So that whole day was nothing but confusion.
And I want to talk about something you said there. You're going into the water, and you had to leave your machine gun behind. Mm-hmm. Now, this is supposed to be not just your protection, but protection for a whole bunch of your fellow soldiers. Right. So now you don't have that. You're coming ashore, and I imagine that there's enemy gunfire and artillery all around you, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there were so many weapons that were dropped by people who did get ashore, who were killed. If you needed a weapon, it was on the beach because the person who was carrying it was probably killed. And there's another quick fact. In a division, there are 15,000 men, 9,000 of which were combatants, frontline troops. And my son, who's writing my biography, did his homework and discovered that the 29th Infantry Division suffered more casualties in World War II in that 11 months from June 44 till May 45 when the war was over. We had 20,000 casualties. Amazing.
That's a heavy number.
Yeah.
And for you, 19 years old, halfway around the world from home, getting shot at without what you were supposed to have to protect you, what in the world was going through your mind?
Well, like I said, fright, confusion, just you weren't thinking very straight, just to survive.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question, but I'm sure a lot of these young people are wondering themselves about it. Were you scared? Did you think that was it? Did you think you were going to see another day beyond June 6th?
No. I never thought I'd live to be 90, but there was a time when I didn't think I was going to live 10 more minutes. That's what war was like.
I believe it. And we look at now, and I'm just looking at your schedule of all the places around the country that you're going to be sharing your talents musically and thinking of all the lives that you've touched, much less your children and grandchildren. You even have great-grandchildren yet?
I do. I have 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild.
And none of them would be here if you had been one of those guys from your division who didn't survive past that day.
Yeah.
And just to talk about some of your decorations in the war, and we're going to get to music, and it all ties together, and it's incredible the path that your life has taken. But you're a recipient two times over of the Bronze Star, which isn't easy to get. You earned the Combat Infantry Badge. If you guys ever see a veteran wearing a little blue rectangular badge with a rifle in the middle of it, that's a combat infantry badge. You only earn that by being in combat, as Colonel Gabriel was. I'm sure you're not dying to talk about why you got this or why you got that, but from D-Day, that's just the beginning. I'm sure you had a whole lot of experience from that point on. What are some of the ones that stand out that remind you of how fortunate or blessed you are to still be around?
Well, I joined the 29th Infantry Division in Europe. As I said, they were there in 42. So I was a replacement. trained in the United States as a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. When I got to the 29th, they said, no, you're going to be a machine gunner. Oh, really? So they trained me on a machine gun. And what they told me, this was absolutely true fact, that the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gun in combat is 3 days. That's what I had to look forward to. And so when we went ashore on D-Day, like I said, we were supposed to take Saint-Lobe, the first big major city in France, in 7 days. And it was the middle of July, so it was about 45 days before we took Saint-Lobe. And then we went to the port of Brest. And the reason we went there, those of you who are history buffs, know that that's where the submarine bases were that scourged our fleets coming from the United States, troop ships and supply ships. And so by taking Brest, we would have silenced all of those submarines. But what we didn't realize is that they had a 240-millimeter cannon, huge. I mean, it was like a freight train when you heard one of those shells coming overhead. And they were trained, of course, into the ocean. But we didn't know that they turned 180 degrees on us. So that's what we faced in Brest.
If you read Colonel Gabriel's book, completed in 2016 with his son Michael, it's called The Force of Destiny, and I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll learn how close we came to missing out on this legendary conductor's global music career, and how he has honored those who never made it home from the war, including some of his closest friends.
I met two men who were replacements for my machine gun squad, Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith. And they were with me for 3 months. Now, that's unusual. Like I said, the expectancy was 3 days. So we became very close. I knew all about their family. And on January 9th, 1945, the three of us were in a machine gun or in a foxhole, and we were hit by a German mortar, and both of them were killed. So they're buried in Margraten Cemetery in Netherlands. And they had their families were looking for somebody that knew their father in combat. So they wrote to the Army Records Section, they wrote to the Veterans Administration, they wrote to everybody they could think of. And then a few years ago, as you know, we built the World War II Memorial. And so I was a charter member. So they wrote to the World War II Memorial and said, is Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith, you know what, where they might be? Because they didn't even know where they were buried. And they said, oh yes, they're members. And I said, how can that be? They were killed back in 45. Well, it was a Staff Sergeant Arnold Gabriel who signed them up as charter members, and that's how they found me. And so we had become very, very close. Harry Ashoff had a 2-year-old son, and that 2-year-old son came to Washington 4 years ago, and I gave them the tour, took him to the World War II Memorial, and he's going to get his car to drive back to New Jersey. And he said, before I leave, he said, I want to ask you something, but before that, I want a hug. So he gave me a hug, and he said, will you be my dad?
That gets you.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of veterans who came home and met their first child for the first time at 3 or 4 years old because they'd been born while they were shipping off or their wife was pregnant while they were shipping off. I've also met children who've had a lifelong quest, like your friend's son, to learn about their parents. So what you provided for him, holy moly, that's powerful. But there's another question that I have after hearing that story, and I bet some of you students are thinking the same thing. You said the three of you were all in the same foxhole, right?
Mm-hmm.
The mortar killed the two of them, but not you.
I was very lucky. I got a concussion and some bruises. I was authorized to get the Purple Heart, and I said, I can't get the Purple Heart. My two buddies were killed. I'm not going to get it for a few bruises, so I didn't get the Purple Heart.
I know this isn't easy to talk about again, but how do you deal with that? Again, you're still a young man, barely older than these kids at Clovis North High School here.
19 years old.
To have your two best friends who've been with you for months killed.
3 months, right. Yeah.
Not to mention what happened to you in the process. How do you process that and move on and continue to stay alive and fight the enemy?
Well, I didn't go right back to the front line. I stayed back with the kitchen unit, which was back in the rear area for 3-4 days until I regained my composure. My lieutenant gave me some advice, which is valuable for everybody in this room. I couldn't deal with reality. I couldn't deal about going back to the front line again. And Lieutenant Butler came to me and he said, I was still a private then. He said, Private Gabriel, he said, now you've got to get on your feet. You've got to get back to the front line and put that all behind you. I said, yeah, but Lieutenant, do you remember Saint-Lobe? Do you remember D-Day? He said, hold it right there. It's okay to look back. Just don't stare. Great advice for everybody. Because we all have things in our lives that were traumatic. But we have to put those things behind us and move on. And that's what I did. After the war was over, I was very confused. I was still only 20 years old when I was separated. And I had the war behind me at 20 years old. And I worked in a factory for 67 cents a day in a warehouse. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to be alone. I didn't want anybody to bother me. And my high school band director came to that factory. And he said, "Arnold, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm making a living." He said, "You're going to college." I said, "I can't go to college. How can I compete with students like you, right out of high school who are playing their instruments?" I hadn't played anything but a machine gun for 3 years. And people who had played in military bands for 3 or 4 years, I can't compete with them. He said, "You're going to college." He insisted. So he went to Ithaca College, which is his alma mater, paid my matriculation fee, waived my audition, literally pushed me into college. And he also went to the band director and the orchestra director and said, "Put this young boy in the first chair." Well, I knew I didn't deserve that. So I said, "Okay, I'll try it for a semester." And I did practice 3 and 4 hours a day so I wouldn't disappoint him or me. I figured out that the only way I was going to get through the war was to keep busy. And to this day, you know my schedule. There is no time for me to think about the war except for times like this. So when I was in college, when I was a sophomore, there was a vacancy for a choir director at a Baptist church, even though I was Catholic, in Cortland, New York. And I went to the pastor and I said, "I would like to apply for the job." He said, "Have you ever conducted choirs?" I said, "Oh, sure." Never had. And the Syracuse Drum and Bugle Corps, they were looking for directors. "Have you ever conducted a drum corps?" "Sure." Never had. I don't know if you know the name Patrick Conway. He was a famous band director along with Sousa and so forth. He was from Homer, New York, by the way, mm-hmm. and also conducted a band there. So I went to the mayor. And now I'm still a sophomore in college. I said, "You know, Patrick Conway used to have a band. Where's all that music and instruments and so forth?" "Oh, they're in the basement of City Hall." I said, "What do you think about starting the band again?" He said, "Well, we need a conductor." And I said, "I can do that." He said, "Have you ever conducted a band?" "Oh, yes." Never had. When the Korean War came about, I decided, well, I'm not going to go back to the infantry. And I knew that the Air Force was looking for band directors, so in 1951, I applied for a job as a band director in the Air Force and was accepted. And the same thing happened. I kept extremely busy by always doing more than was expected of me. Not so much that I thought it was necessary for my mission, but it was more for me to keep busy than anything else. And of course, I have many, many stories about my experiences in Germany and the Air Force Band in Washington, D.C.
And you can read so many of those in the book Force of Destiny. But as he prepares to again journey to Normandy for the 75th anniversary of D-Day, there's a good chance those emotions he experienced 3/4 of a century ago will come flooding back, just as they did 5 years ago.
It's always with me. At the beach of Normandy, we did Hymn to the Fallen from Saving Private Ryan. Not only was I bawling, but half the band was bawling too.
What was the audience like?
Well, they came from all over that Normandy area. And the little old ladies that were alive in World War II, not many men were because they were either killed or died since, come up and kiss me on both cheeks with tears in their eyes because I'm still, to them, a liberator.
You are. And if we were all to go there right now, there are a lot of things that we could see. I mean, we could see that same beach that they came ashore. You could even see some of the military equipment that was there at the time. You could see the little church in St. Mary Eglise with a paratrooper still hanging from it, just as he was that day when John Steele got hung up on the steeple. There are a lot of things that we could see that remind us of it, but we weren't there, and you were. And here on a day, the 70th anniversary, when the President of the United States and all these other world leaders are there, you're there conducting a band, not just as something that's interesting to you, but something that you lived and something that killed your friends. What did that feel like to be in that spot at that moment doing what you were doing?
Well, the President of France was also there, along with the President Obama. And on YouTube, you can see the President giving the speech at the military cemetery where 9,600 people who died at Normandy are buried. And I'm sitting directly behind the President when he finishes his speech, he turned around and shook hands with, there were only about, I think, 20 or 30 veterans of D-Day who were there. And both presidents shook hands with me, and that's on YouTube. That, again, very, very moving.
I know you don't stare when you look back. You made that clear to us, and I'm going to remember that. That's a powerful statement. But do you ever look back and say, why me? How did this all work out the way it did for me? Why am I the one that survived all of this, that has had all these opportunities, and here I am all these years later still going and having the privilege of honoring all those guys who aren't still here?
Well, yeah, there's almost a feeling of guilt. But on the other hand, I feel like I have to continue to give, that my life was spared, and as long as I can continue to give, I'm going to. And I have 3 contacts to conduct when I'm 100 years old, and I'm going to do it, by the way.
No one who's ever had the privilege of meeting Colonel Gabriel would ever question that guarantee. So keep an eye out for him on June 6th. And to access the complete original interview with him or the other D-Day survivors you heard from today, visit hometownheroesradio.com. Again, you can also find the full speech from President Reagan on D-Day's 40th anniversary there. And I think the final words of his address that day would be a fitting way to wrap things up today.
Here in this place, where the West held together, let us make a vow to our dead. Let us show them by our actions that we understand what they died for. Let our actions say to them the words for which Matthew Ridgway listened, I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Strengthened by their courage, heartened by their value, and borne by their memory, let us continue to stand for the ideals for which they lived and died. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.
Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.